You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 4th of September, 2024. I want to take somewhat of a break from my normal run of topics that I deal with here, because even I get tired of them. I want to talk about something that I've hinted at, but I've never done a full show on. And that's the theories of a book called IQ and the Wealth of Nations from psychologist Richard Lynn. It was co-authored by Tatu van Hanen, who was a political scientist who died in 2025. It seemed off the top of my head that this is a very obvious point. But at least with certain ethnicities, certain races, there is so much variability that it vitiates the overall theory. American blacks, for example, do not vitiate the overall theory. And let me start off with a quote here, directly from Richard Lynn. The results of the correlation analyses indicate that positive correlations between national IQ and per capita income and long-term economic growth have existed since 1820, and the correlations between national IQ and measures of per capita income have become somewhat stronger during more recent decades. Thus, differences in national intelligence provide a powerful explanation for the persistent and increasing gap between rich and poor countries over the period from 1820 to the end of the 20th century. And I fully accept that as far as it goes, but nothing's ever purely quantitative. Nothing's ever merely reducible to numbers. There's a lot more going on here than meets the eye. And it really depends on the group that it's connected to. So, in this book, which I read years ago, there is a clear relationship between national intelligence and economic development. They use 81 countries, and the relationship between national IQs and measures of per capita income. They use basic correlation, which that's your first year statistics class, and regression analysis, which is your second year. And there is strong support to this. Per capita income specifically has been positively correlated with national IQ since they began doing this in 1820. As far as I'm concerned, it only formalizes what was known before. I didn't need a regression analysis to know this. Oh, and I should note that the Finnish co-author, Van Hanen, he was almost brought up on charges. There was an interview, and this hits close to home, as we all know. There was an interview where he stated, whereas the average IQ of Finns is 97, and Africans between 60 and 70, differences in intelligence are the most significant factor in explaining poverty. That was called they called out the Finnish National Bureau of Investigation. They wanted to call out this body for an investigation, but they eventually decided against it. They came to the conclusion that he had not incited any kind of hatred. And he stated an obvious fact. when it's connected between a group of people like the Finns and Africans. It is a powerful, but not total, explanation for the gap between rich and poor countries. Of course, it's not the only variable that matters, but it's a powerful one. And academics can't talk about it because they're not allowed to, as I just mentioned. Now, there's a lot of complexity here. Part of it is that you still have mismanaged economies. You know, socialist command economies, they've been much less favorable for economic development, regardless of IQ. No one can get to North Korea's IQ, as far as I know. Using the world population, well, I forget. There's so many. By the way, there's a million variables here, ways to measure this. Average IQ by country, 2025. This is put out by the International IQ Test, which they run every year. It's based on data from 1,352,763 people, as far as 2024 was concerned. So this is a huge group of people, and they use the one of the acultural, the Raven matrices in this case. So it's just spatial manipulation and things like that. So South Korea is number 2 at 106. You could only assume that North Korea would be very close. However, given what we're going to talk about, maybe it wouldn't, because there's other variables at play here. So that's at least one complexity. Now, as far as the Lin book, it wasn't a random sample. They went from all over the world. It certainly was a representative one. All the major countries were included, and most of the world population was included in it. And so you can't attack him from that point of view. So let me summarize the basic idea. It's a little more complicated than most people realize. The first explanation for the association between national intelligence and economic development lies in an extension of the principle that there is a positive association between intelligence and earnings among people within countries. That association exists because individuals with high IQs can produce goods and services for which there was a great demand, that people, countries with many low IQ people are unable to provide. As a result of this, the high IQ country can command higher incomes. Now, they're neutral in terms of what a nation is, but they're clearly talking about nations as entities. And they certainly differ in IQs, but they differ over time. And it's more than just, we'll get to this in a second, the Flynn effect is more than just that. Considered in more detail, the economic advantages gained, nations whose population have high IQs are secured in 6 ways. And this is just the basics here. Number 1, intelligence is a major determinant of educational attainment. They perform well in school. They achieve high, you know, standards. Those attainments provide the skilled labor force and human capital needed for strong economic growth. Number 2, that in fact produces a strong scientific elite that can then innovate. They mentioned Britain in the 19th century, for better or for worse. As a result of their high IQ as a nation. 3, these populations can provide other non-scientific but complex and cognitively demanding goods and services, like banking, insurance. They even mention the fashion industry in Paris and Milan, the perfume industry in Paris, and things like that, that are not of the highest intellectual rigor, but do require some ability. Number 4, the research is extraordinary, showing that intelligence is associated with efficient work performance, regardless of anything else. Nations whose population have high IQs, on average, create large numbers of people of moderate to high intelligence who can carry out the middle management things that are necessary for an economy to run. The skilled work in the private sector that any successful economy depends upon. They're not the exception, they're the rule. Number five, those nations have relatively few people that have low levels of intelligence. Of course, unless they import them. Those people might be considered to be a burden on the state. At most, they do unskilled labor. So there's an association between low intelligence and unemployment among individuals. And they mentioned this relationship holds UK, the US, and France. And six, nations, the populations have low IQ, have very large primary sectors, agricultural, mining sectors. Thus, in areas where there is a weak demand, there is surplus. Now, there's some exceptions, like the high price of oil, diamonds and gold in Botswana. You know, there's exceptions to that. But generally speaking, low IQ means primary producing. And there's been plenty of studies conducted over a period of a century have shown that intelligence is an important and central correlate. I mean, I don't think that anyone really needs to hear this. This is a common sense idea, but in the U.S. today, it has to be said that intelligence is necessary for a wide range of economic and social phenomena. What is IQ associated with? I mean, educational attainment, socioeconomic status, earnings, lifetime achievement. Low intelligence, significant determinant of unemployment, poverty, welfare, dependency, even things like single motherhood, early death and crime. Again, it seems to be a common sense issue. So I was a bit surprised when I came across a 2012 article by Ron Unz, the American conservative, that had an issue with some of this. And it's very difficult to argue with him. There are limits to what he says here. He's not refuting it per se, but he doesn't have a one-to-one causal concept like the authors do. Of course, IQ is important, and most of it's inherited. But it may be too simple as a measure. Now, as many of you know, when that book came out, and the Bell Curve, a few others like that, academics scored points with the regime by condemning the book. Sometimes for no reason, they just blurted out. But there was, Unz mentions Charles Kenny, World Bank economist specializing in international development, who attacked this idea. And it wasn't really substantial. The subtitle is, Are development exports becoming racist? He's arguing that a growing number of development economists, those who deal with the third world, were turning towards, quote, genetic and other intrinsic human traits as central explanations of national economic progress, often elevating those above the investment and regulatory issues that have long been the focus of international agencies. And actually, he attacked this book, calling it extreme and hateful, arguing that they are demanding eugenics, which they are not. They did not. And that IQ scores for different populations are, for the most part, fixed and hereditary. Now, that's simply not true. And that's where the problem comes in. But for its opponents to come out and say that the IQ theories are bad because they're racist and deeply offensive, and that they've been debunked anyway, and then call out idiots like Stephen Jay Gould in The Mismeasure of Man, And he was made fool, because, you know, if anyone's been debunked, Gould has been. And Gould just didn't care about anything. He was a Jew, of course, a Marxist, a Jew. And his fraud in his career was pretty well known. One simple statement of fact: in Gould's case, he claimed the physical volume of human skulls were all the same, and it's simply not true. But it doesn't matter. Kenny was virtue signaling. All the people in the academies, one paper after another, it didn't matter if anyone asked for it. This is when I could really show the world that I am on the side of the regime. I could never be fired now. I'll condemn this book. It's just an odd issue that to have to explain to people that intelligence has something to do with developing what the regime calls an advanced economy. Seems to be a very obvious thing. I'm shocked that it was published at all. The publisher did pay dearly. I mentioned what happened to the co-author. So let's step back a little bit. You have a lot of complexities, and one of them is this very definition of intelligence. IQ scores are a rough conception of that trait. So in this book, they collected a bunch for the last 50 or 60 years. Remember, this is over 20 years ago now. They're comparing them to income levels and economic growth rates. And there is something called the Flynn effect, which I have to mention. So the authors had to adjust their raw scores. Still, there was a strong correlation. Part of it is that when a society becomes industrialized and advanced in that sense of the term, IQ scores go up, at least with some people. IQs have been going up, according to Flynn, for many years. That's not entirely false. But different groups of people, different races, different ethnic groups, don't feel that in the same way. However, you would think of something like South Africa since 1990. The average IQ had to have gone way down, if that's true. Ukraine had to experience a drop too, and they are way down on the list compared with Russia. Well, there is some sense to that. But here's how the authors define intelligence. In contemporary psychology, intelligence is conceptualized as primarily a unitary construct that determines the efficiency of problem-solving, learning, remembering, and the performance of tasks ranging from complex mathematical and logical problems to simple reaction times involving the speed of pressing a button on a keyboard when a light comes on. Okay. And in 97, there was an editorial in the journal Intelligence, L.S. Gottfredson. And here's what he said. Intelligence is a very general mental capacity, which, among other things, involves the ability to reason, plan, solve problems, think abstractly, comprehend complex ideas, learn quickly, and learn from experience. It's not just book learning, a narrow academic skill, or test-taking smarts. Rather, it reflects a broader and deeper capability for comprehending our surroundings, catching on, making sense of things, figuring out what to do, etc. Now, I don't think much of that would be debatable. The only reason there's been any discussion about IQ at all is because blacks score so low, black Africans, that is, and in the U.S., black Americans score far, far below whites and Asians. That's a huge piece of evidence against their theory. So they're constantly at war with it. That's the only reason. Now, I'm no friend of the social sciences. This stuff came out in 1904 by Charles Spearman, arguing that all cognitive abilities are interrelated. In other words, that people who do well on some things tend to do well on other things. And he created the factor analysis method in statistics to show that the efficiency of performance on all cognitive tasks is partly determined by a common factor. And that is just the letter G, general intelligence. There must be some general mental power that determines the performance on all cognitive tasks and is responsible for positive intercorrelation of these things. Of course, there's also the Dunning-Kruger effect. That's a separate issue. But what's the Flynn effect? It's the substantial, and not just substantial, but also a sustained increase in all forms of intelligence test scores that were measured in many parts of the world over the 20th century. It was named after a researcher, a leftist, James Flynn, who died in 2020. Who really condemned the whole notion. He thought they were useful, but only if they were manipulated in the right way. He wrote a book in 2007 called What is Intelligent? Again, the only reason was virtue signaling here. He said, there have been thousands of blacks of genius or talent. And who does he cite? St. Augustine? Victor Hugo, Paul Robeson, and Thomas Sowell? A bizarre set of lists. Of course, a list of people. St. Augustine was white. He was a Berber. Victor Hugo was white. Paul Robeson was certainly black. I'm not sure of the connection between singing and high IQ. And Thomas Sowell, who certainly is very light-skinned, who has quite a bit of talent. But those were his four examples. Even on the individual level. And there's, of course, a difference between the individual level and the national level. Intelligence leads to economic success. And IQ scores lead to economic success. Among many other things. Of course, it could also lead to, you know, being Lex Luthor. But that's not what they're talking about here. And much of that is genetic. I took my IQ test in third grade. I was in the 120s, I think. Both my sons were 130, 131. Which is why they were in the gifted programs. They didn't get that from her. I'm telling you that right now. And it was all third grade. It's not what you know. It's your capacity to know. But the implication is that, at least within, not necessarily with individuals, but within nations, it should stay the same regardless. If this is truly innate, well, the Flynn effect shows that it hasn't. If high national IQ scores are correlated with economic success, perhaps the high IQ scores actually caused it. Then the question is, is that success driving high IQs? Or is there a third factor at play? Now, initially, when this first came out, the concept of an IQ test, it's conceivable it was biased towards the Western mentality. But that was a very long time ago. There's also the effect of things like malnutrition or, you know, deprivation or whatever. Difficulties in administering tests in different groups of people. And Kenny emphasized this too. He's not totally wrong on that. But since then, there have been many, many, many culture-neutral versions. They all have their different names of the test, even those blatantly skewed to non-whites. In fact, in the U.S., there was an IQ test that was designed with a massive bias in favor of Black America, and whites still dominated that. But regardless, IQ is associated with general high achievement. You know my opinion on quantitative figures. Quantity has to be dealt with by quality. There's a long list of enormous variations in tested IQs of genetically indistinguishable European peoples. Across everything, temporal, geographic, political lines, variations so large that they can't be explained as just simple errors. And he brings out a few examples. Germany. And this is prior to the unification in 1991. West Germany, you had what you might expect, an IQ range from 99 to 107. However, in 1967, a sample of East Germans produced a score of just 90. It wasn't until unification, or just before unification, that went up to 97 to 99. So clearly, it can't be merely a genetic deterministic idea. Of course, East Germans and West Germans are indistinguishable, genetically speaking. But you had a 17-point gap at one point. And then, a massive explosion of East German scores. That has to be explained. He mentions the Poles. 1979 to 1989. At one point, there was a 92 was their score a long time ago, coming from a huge sample of 4,000 children tested with progressive matrices, you know, one of the most culturally independent methods. Yeah, the Slovaks had 96 in 1983. The Czechs scored 96 to 98 in 1983. Hungarians, not quite 100 in 1979. It's almost as if these scores tend to follow per capita GDP, the relative countries. But at the same period of time, the far wealthier non-communist nations, especially in Northern Europe, all scored above 100, generally speaking. There's still a gap that has to be explained here, especially when you're talking about, in many cases, identical people. Austrians and Croats, for example, you know, they're not that different from each other. There's a 12-point gap, in fact, between Croats and Austrians within the Yugoslav Federation. Let me quote Ron Unz here to clear this up a little bit. It seems more plausible that most of the large and consistent IQ gaps between Western Europeans and their Balkan cousins are less a cause than a consequence of differences in development and affluence during the era in which these IQ tests were taken. For example, Austria had many times Croatia's per capita GDP during this same period. One of the few European nations to exhibit a sharp decline in tested IQ in Poland went from 106 in 79 to 92 in 1989, did so within economic turmoil. That needs to be taken seriously. Poland, depending on the measure, is 99.39, according to the international IQ test. But that is a different method. It's supposed to be a culturally neutral method. So you had a difference between 10 or even 15 IQ points between the impoverished Balkan and Eastern Europeans and wealthy Western Europeans. That can't be a matter of genetics. Not to mention the fact that when they immigrated to the U.S., they changed yet again. Americans of Greek and South Slav origins are considerably above most American whites in both family income and educational level. The Lind data on Jews is also very interesting. American Jews claim to have the highest tested IQs. They claim 110, 115 range. But what do Israeli Jews have? One large sample from 1989 put it at 90. A smaller sample from 1975 was 97. And both of those attempts deliberately excluded Arabs. IQ gaps with American Jews are enormous, even as much as 25 points, You can't explain this by genetic factors. Now, the measure that I like, the international IQ test, as of 2025, Israel sits at 45th place, just under 100. Again, that's the international IQ test site. Now, in 1990, the test of South African whites put it at 94, which is below the Dutch and English peoples from which they came from. Now, if this theory is true, it might be lower today, given the nature of the collapse of their system. Now, Ireland, for example, again, remained for the most part rural during the 70s, even in the 80s, had a real per capita GDP less than half of the U.S. The Irish IQ was at 93, based on two samples taken from the 1970s. And yet Irish Americans are far higher than that. The 1972 one was about 3,500 Irish school children, one of the largest samples. And this is directly from the book, by the way. And the other in 79, just 75 Irish adults, which is weaker. But still, the average then there is a massive gap here. Again, Ireland is at 98.32, according to the IIQT. So in the 70s, it was at 87, lowest figure anywhere in Europe, at a full standard deviation below that of Irish Americans at the same time. Now, there was an article that Lynn put out in the Personality Individual Differences. That's actually the name of the journal. And there's an interview there where he talks about, and this is Ron Unz describing this here. He says he initially was appointed research professor in Dublin, and his responsibility was to investigate all the problems there in the country. And very arrogantly, he concluded that it was the backward nature of the country, and that was the low IQ of its people. He did mention genetics in that particular case. He knew he wouldn't get anywhere with that. But he claims, now he didn't publish this, he claims he said this. He relocated to Ulster later on. Now, how true that is, I don't know. In fact, it was the Ireland case that led to the IQ in the Wealth of Nations. And I'm not sure how he got away with some of this stuff, because Northern Ireland, part of the UK, the same hate speech laws apply. I'm not sure he ever advocated genetics, and he may have. But he didn't publish it at the time he sat on it. You have to explain high Irish American IQs with the lower, much lower IQs of Irishmen in Ireland. It seems that the IQ seems to be a very, very simple explanation for this. Now, we have to pause here. The gathering of data is always, there's a million ways of measuring IQs. There's a million studies. The farther back you go, the more difficult it is to get trustworthy numbers. Sampling problems are an eternal problem. But that doesn't explain any of this. These are enormous variations. They have their own pattern. Well-developed countries have IQs of about 100 or above. Their close kinsmen in much poorer regions have lower scores. That has to be explained. Now, according to the International IQ Test Agency, using the Raven Matrix, here's the top 10 countries in terms of IQ. China is number one, 107.19. South Korea, 106.43. Japan, 106.4. Number four is Iran, 106.3. Number five, Singapore, 105.14. Russia, 103.16. At six, number seven, Mongolia, 102.86. Number eight, Armenia, at 102. Number nine, Australia, 102. And Spain, number 10, at 102. Israel is 45th in this, according to this particular agency. The U.S. is in 30th place. Now, what got me a little worried, they have the Congo, or the Central African Republic, at 122nd place, with an IQ of 88. Seems to be a little high. The World Population Review has the Congo at the average IQ of 62.5. Sudan's at 72. Sierra Leone is under 70. Nigeria hovers around 70. The black population of South Africa hovers around 65. That's taken from Lynn. Now, of course, there are substantial differences in ranking depending on your method, on your political agenda, or whatever. But the International IQ Testing Agency has a different set of numbers. If Russia is number six in the world at 103, Ukraine is way down at 95.38, number 78. Well, that makes some sense. Now, Venezuela, who suffered greatly, is at 91, but has actually gained 2 points over the last few years, which may vitiate some of this. Sri Lanka is at 12th place with 102, and Vietnam at 100. So I'm not sure if this vitiates this idea or not. Let me quote Unz again. The central thesis of Lyndon Van Hanen's work is that IQ accurately reflects intelligence, that IQ is overwhelmingly determined by genetics, and that IQ is subject to little or no significant cultural or economic influence after we adjust for the universal Flynn effect. Since the IQ disparities discussed above seem to provide a powerful challenge to this theory, their validity has sometimes been disputed, on the grounds that populations being compared may actually be more dissimilar than we realize, due to the impact of selective migration. Still, this hardly invalidates the connection between IQ and income. As I've said many times before, the story is always more complicated. Now, speaking of Thomas Sowell, wrote American Ethnic Groups. It came out in 1978. He deals with IQ in it. Dealing with the 1920s. There, the Slovaks had an average IQ of 85.6, Greeks at 83, Poles at 85, the Spanish at 78, Northern Italians at 78, Southern Italians at 85. And there was another one, World War I draftees in 1923, published then, had very similar conclusions. That certainly is not the case now. Now, we all know that IQ at least is a significant factor. It's not a total factor. It's a significant factor. And our opponents and academics, they've put out as many fraudulent things as they possibly could. Stephen Jay Gould is one of the worst, but, you know. So if so many genetically indistinguishable European populations of vaguely similar, or roughly similar cultural and historical backgrounds, without severe nutritional difficulties, can display such massive variances in IQ scores across different decades and locations, what does that mean? That means there has to be a cultural environmental element to this. This makes perfect sense. The element that's missing is the nation. It's nationhood. And everything goes along with that. Public trust. a functional economy. Positive thinking to the future. Now, I haven't mentioned blacks yet, or African. You know, American blacks, totally different story. Nothing has changed there. But this only seems to apply to European and some Asian populations. We're talking about 10, 15-point IQ disparities in all of this. Not just in space, but also in time. Now, Und calls it the weak IQ hypothesis, which is acceptable. That it is a factor, but certainly not the only factor. Now, all of this, by the way, none of this is rejected in this book. None of this is rejected by Lin and Van Hunen. They claim to know this book. This is one of the things where this book gets mentioned a lot, like the bell curve, but doesn't get read. Leftists don't want to read this, right? They're afraid that their little world may come crashing down. But who wants to read, this dry, 300 pages of detailed quantitative evidence? Go to the summary text. I think that's likely to be true. But of course, anything that goes into the popular culture, or such as it is in the U.S., is going to be simplified and destroyed. So there really hasn't been a whole lot of attention to the actual data that they provide in the book. There was a sense that there was an innate mental inferiority of Southern and Eastern European groups many decades ago. And yet they outperform most white ethnic groups today. Now, Unz mentions the Mexicans, and I have never once heard someone say, we can't have the Mexicans come in because they have lower IQs and they're going to drag us down to their level. The IQ figure that they quote from Lin is 87. However, they admit that it's based on one 1961 study of Mexican kids in the most impoverished southern part of that country. It seems that Mexicans and Irish seem to not just have the same intellectual ability here, but the massive changes over time have been very similar. It's not a matter of, it's not an anomaly here. Ireland has become one of the best educated countries in Europe. Now, he mentions that, I told you what the Irish IQ is as of 2025, and that would reflect that. And don't forget, in 2006, they came out with another book, IQ and Global Inequality. They said that by 93, the average Irish IQ had risen to 92. Again, doesn't necessarily invalidate the thesis, just the strong statement of the thesis. Here's what Unz writes in the 2022 article, which is very interesting. Meanwhile, tens of millions of Mexican Americans have lived in the U.S. with this far higher standard of living for decades. You must wonder if they have demonstrated any similar rise in IQ. Lin and Van Hanen provide some early 1970 studies for Mexican-American children living in Texas and California. They were very low, similar to Mexico itself. And you would think that if Mexican-Americans had demonstrated a large rise in tested intelligence, the media and the ethnic advocacy groups would have widely trumpeted this fact by now. Now, there is some new data, GSS data, in the General Social Survey, a huge sociological survey conducted every other year. Tens of thousands of Americans have been subject to a wide range of detailed questions, and the responses made available over the web. There's the Wordsum vocabulary identification test. It's crude. It correlates 0.71 with the results of standard IQ tests. Pretty good. Certainly a huge. Now the other tests I mentioned several times, the list that I mentioned, they have over a million. There have been plenty of bloggers that have talked about it at great length. So in the 1970s, you had a relatively low IQ, 84, 85 for this particular one. But the Mexican-American IQ then jumped 7 points by the 1990s, an additional 3 points in the 2000s. Ultimately, 10 full points in just 20 years. While the same increase was just for white Americans rose just two points during that same period. And again, there's some intermarriage with whites. There's a lot of other factors going on. I don't want to oversimplify that either. But Un switches topics here, using the wordsome IQ issue, which I guess I have no problem with it. 84.4 in 1980s, 95.1 in the 2000s. The rise for American whites was from 99.2 to 101.3 at the same time. In other words, almost two-thirds of the IQ gap between American-born Mexican-Americans and whites disappeared in 2 decades. These results being based on representative American samples of substantial size. So this isn't there isn't a clear connection. There is when we get to Africa. Asians have never changed. At least, you know, the East Asians, the elite East Asians have never changed, and black Africans have never changed. Black Americans have changed slightly. Let's talk about American blacks here. Despite their many privileges in American society, endless privileges. Professor Flynn, the Flynn Effect guy, he said the causes of the black-white IQ difference are purely environmental. He says that the American black-white IQ gap has been declining. He asserts that between 1970 and 92, the gap decreased by 5.5 IQ points. And if you bring that into the future, there'll be a certain level of convergence. Now, Professors Rushton and Jensen, who wrote in the journal Psychology, Public Policy, and Law in 2005, in an article, 30 Years of Research on Race Differences in Cognitive Ability, refuted this. They completely reject the idea that there's been a reduction in the gap between blacks and whites in the U.S. From 1917 to 2008, there has been no black gain in average IQ. 1954 to 2008, no gain in average black educational achievement measured by math and reading in the National Assessment of Educational Progress Studies. That is to say, not them going to school, but them actually producing something. Despite the endless privileges in a wealthy society, at one time was a wealthy society. So, in black Africa and in American blacks, you do have a far more powerful genetic connection. East Asians, China, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, you haven't had any changes. That's very interesting. So we're only talking about European ethnicities, which are a bit more malleable. Now, Rushton and Jensen accept that IQs of both blacks and whites have increased since the 1930s. But then they claim that the G component, as we mentioned before, that has not increased at all. Now, intelligence can be divided between G and non-G components. G is the general factor, as I mentioned earlier, a partial determinant of performance on all cognitive tasks, as I mentioned. The non-G components are other abilities that are independent of G, reasoning, verbal comprehension, spatial ability, memory, and all the rest. Now, whether or not there's really a huge difference there, I don't know. That's a completely separate issue. But the general factor is basic social intelligence. Rustin and Jensen use various techniques to measure both G and non-G components of intelligence. Non-G they have increased, probably as a result among blacks, education, health, nutrition, whatever. Of course, they'll be condemned immediately. I don't know how this stuff was even published, except, you know, they always, you know, say that this is not racial, and, you know, they go on and on about that. They don't live easy lives. There's plenty of people who say that G can be separated from non-G. I question that. But they do come to the conclusion that there's been no gap. The black-white gap in the U.S. has not declined since 1917. Clearly, the environment of American blacks has improved greatly since 1917. Higher living standards, better health care, integrated schooling, full civil rights, affirmative action. Endless, they're given everything they want. Yes, the environment of whites, especially white females, has improved, but blacks much more so. So it depends on the group we're talking about, and this is the main complexity. Even Rushton and Jensen may have underestimated the genetic contribution of this black-white IQ gap. They put it at 80%. Well, if there's been no decline in that gap since 1917, then it'd be higher than that. I'm quite willing to believe the same thing goes for Central Africa. So it seems like we're only talking about certain European and very possibly South Asian and Western Asian peoples where you see increases or decreases in IQ given their environment. And we have many examples of large populations whose IQs have drastically shifted over fairly short periods of time. And of course, I don't have the solution to that. No one does. But it seems that on the very top and on the very bottom, they're simply that's who they are. But especially Europeans in the middle, upper middle, that can change, that their brains are simply more malleable. Again, the Flynn effect, which was publicized by Lynn. The consistent, regular rise in nominal IQs for populations almost everywhere in the world. Englishmen, Frenchmen today do better on IQ tests than they did their parents or grandparents did. But we don't have any reason to believe that they're any smarter. I'd say the opposite. That's the difference between G and non-G intelligence. Now, there's been some speculation. The rise in IQ test performance is based on the complex and technological environment surrounding us. We're always thinking in these terms. Life in modern urban societies today has become really a course for IQ tests. But if I'm right about this, that would mean if we can get North Korean IQ scores, and I wouldn't trust anything from either side of this, it would be the same as South Korea. It would have to be. The one thing Un says that I don't like is the rural-urban divide. That the lower IQs do come from rural people. Higher IQs from the exact same ethnic group is when they become urbanized. Well, I have a problem with it because there's much to be, in the farming life. There's just as much intelligence necessary as working in a factory. you know, but more recently, that's a separate issue. I mean, blacks in America today are almost entirely urban, and nothing has changed. But among certain white ethnic groups, they are more malleable, given circumstances. Owen says this, "This pattern of apparently inverted white ethnic achievement in Europe and America becomes less mysterious when we discover it tracks quite well with the rural versus urban divide. Two of the most heavily rural, least urbanized groups are the Dutch Americans and the old stock whites, perform the worst, while the high-performing Italians, Greeks, and Yugoslavs are among the most heavily urbanized. German Americans are slightly less urbanized than the average white, also tend to perform slightly below average. In fact, across all non-Hispanic American whites, the Wurzheim-IQ gap, which is just a vocabulary thing, between those who grew up on farms and those who grew up in cities or suburbs is nearly as large as the gap separating American blacks from whites, and even larger with regard to total years of education." Well, it clearly doesn't apply to blacks. And he vehemently underestimates the intelligence needed in rural life. I think what it could mean is that everything moves so much faster. Think of what the human brain was designed to do. It wasn't designed to drive cars. It wasn't designed to deal with a million people a day. You know, especially you're a business owner or something. You're a waitress or a waiter. Think of the number of calculations that the brain has to do when you're going down a highway versus the number of calculations they used to do with the horse and buggy. So it's not a matter of intelligence. It's just that there's more stress on the brain. Hence, there's a problem with IQ scores. But let's talk about blacks again. Lowest IQs in the world. All right? The Bushmen have maybe 50 IQ, average Bantu, maybe 70. African Americans, maybe 80, 85 at the highest. That clearly has a massive impact on lifestyle, achievement, behavior, everything else. Poverty, crime, mortality, broken homes. On one side, in the education, wealth, human accomplishment, long life, and stable homes, on the other. Now, according to the IQ of the Wealth of Nations, a country should have a minimum IQ of 90 to run a technological civilization. I'm not sure they say that. But I've come across this before. There clearly is a connection, depending on who you're talking to. To claim that intelligence, I don't care how you define it, has nothing to do with the total collapse of black economies in Africa, in places like Haiti, places like Jamaica. How many times has the U.S. rebuilt Haiti? Nigerian named Chigozie Oboima, who I might note is a professor for a while at Nebraska Lincoln, but I'm sure entirely based on his race, and somehow he was named Foreign Policy's 100 Leading Global Thinkers in 2015. I don't know anyone who's ever heard of him. But he wrote in 2016 an article called "There Are No Successful Black Nations." Let me quote him here. "Nigeria, the most populous black nation on earth, is on the brink of collapse. The machinery that makes the nation exist, let alone succeed, have all eroded. One might argue the nation's creation by self-seeking white imperialists engendered its failure from the beginning. But that's only part of the cause. A culture of incompetence, endemic corruption, dignified ineptitude, and chief among all, destructive selfishness and greed, has played a major role in its unraveling. The same, sadly, can be said for most other African nations. Zimbabwe, Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, and the mockery, the farcical democracies ruled by men who exclusively cater to their own interests and those of their eclipse circles. Well, that's something else. He does try to mention white imperialists and everything else, but even at most, he says it's only part of the issue. You should note that blacks who initially lived on that territory before colonization didn't have a country because they had no conception of it. South Africa was our ultimate. We all predicted, if you're as old as I am, we all predicted what was going to happen in 1991, 92. A lot of us were attacked. I was physically attacked very briefly. That's going to destroy the country in every way. Nigeria is swimming in oil. Not just oil, but gems and gold. But the minute blacks took over, none of this mattered. I mentioned before, the Royal Dutch Shell, they couldn't stay in Nigeria because there was no one on the ground to run their equipment. Now they're being sued because of the oil spills due to the Biafran conflict. There are no successful black nations. One might argue that the nation's creation by self-seeking white imperialists engendered its failure from the beginning. Well, there was no nation, certainly, before that. I think someone mentioned that there's a Nigerian satellite now. In my personal experience, Nigerians in America have been very polite. They usually are in mathematics and stuff like that, engineering. The word Nebraska, the word St. Louis. But Nigeria didn't make these satellites. They were made by their trading partners. This was launched for them on completely foreign platforms. And everything that blacks tend to say about themselves are usually based on some kind of fraud or some exaggeration. So let me wind it up this way. These are the final words of the Lynn book. The two most important implications of our study are these. First, the world needs a new international moral code based on the recognition of significant national differences in human mental abilities and consequent economic inequalities. The populations of rich countries may have to accept the fact that they have an ethical obligation to provide financial assistance for the peoples of the poor countries for an indefinite future. Just as within countries, the rich accept that they have ethical obligations to pay taxes and support their own poor. Second, rich countries' economic aid programs for the poor should be continued, and some of these should be directed at attempting to increase the intelligence levels of the population by improving things like nutrition and the like. The recognition that differences in intelligence are a major cause of national economic disparities should make it possible to reduce the differences in the wealth of nations. Those are the last words there. And it's conceivable that he's right. But there are no development economists who can sit here and say, well, we have to structure our aid program for Central African Republic because they have an IQ of 60, whatever it is. They're not allowed to say that. They wouldn't say it anyway. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion. Talk Radio for the nationalist community.